Today, after the deluge. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today I'm joined by Robbie Barwick from the Citizen Party. Hello, Robbie.
Hello, Martin.
Well, it's happened. We're in the middle of it. The question is, what do we do next?
That's right. This is what a financial crash looks like. We're putting out a release in a little while. The first line is, the next global financial crisis is well and truly underway, but don't let the culprits get away with just blaming the coronavirus. This is a financial crisis. We can't let them get away with blaming what's happening on the coronavirus. That is what's happening in the financial markets. But that said, we need an economy, not a financial system, primarily an economy that can handle such a threat as we're having from the coronavirus. And we don't have that either. We have a very poor bubble financial system, which is copying it now. And I think the bubble is blowing in front of our eyes. And we have a very unprepared economy. And what I'd like to do today is talk about where we need to go with the economy, right? So that we can set ourselves up for survive this and save Australia from it and set ourselves up for future prosperity.
Well, it's very important because at the moment, you know, the powers that be are worried about protecting the financial system, right?
Yes.
And all the central banks are throwing money around and liquidity around to try and protect the financial system. But they've forgotten that the financial system is only an enabling capability for a real economy. And unfortunately, in real life, in the real economy, people are already hurting. People will be hurting as we go ahead even more. And we just need a different approach, don't we?
We do. I mean, I'm one of those people that are taking this coronavirus very seriously. I know there's varying degrees of people doing that, but you can see from the supermarket shelves whether they're taking it seriously or not. There's a lot of panic out there about the implications of all this. When you see the way our governments are responding at the moment, the United States government, the Australian government, other governments, you can see, unfortunately, that they are putting the financial system first. Right. And there's actually a good reason for that if you're them, because it is a bubble. They've allowed for over decades our economies to be based on a financial bubble. Right. And they know they cannot survive. That bubble is incapable of surviving this kind of crisis. Problem is, nothing they can do and nothing they have done and nothing they can do is going to work to save that bubble. In fact, Martin, I was really struck last night on the normal 6 o'clock television news. There'd been a 9.7% drop in the stock market in Australia yesterday, if I got that right, roughly then, nearly 10%. It didn't lead the news, right? That would, under any other circumstance, that would lead the news? No. People, there's been a shift in the public's perception. Everyone's more worried about this. And so the government is talking like, it's why they're incapable of coming up with leadership on this issue, because it's not their number one priority. Now, that may be changing this week. There's probably signs of that. But I would still, my concern with them is, I don't think they understand how an economy works, right? So at best, they're going to be coming up with band-aid ad hoc reactions to events rather than being out in front and understand the approach they've got to take. And that's what we need to get people to start thinking about. What sort of approach do we need to take to both address this crisis and make sure our economy functions in the future?
Yeah, no, I agree with that, Robbie. The issue I have, and by the way, Mathias Cormann on the ABC this morning did concede that there would be people out of work, there would be failing businesses. So in a way, that's the first time that I think I've heard the government acknowledge the fact that this is serious. And of course, Trump said, well, we might get a recession in the US. So there's a beginning now to begin to be a realization that this is actually economically serious for the real world. But if indeed all they do is just paper over the cracks again and throw more debt at it and more liquidity, hoping that somehow magically this is going to get a different outcome this time from 12 years ago, then I'm afraid that they're just going to be badly mistaken and it's going to actually damage our economy more. We need a different approach. It needs to be focused, I think, to put the financial system back in its box, to enable it to support real productive activity in the real economy. And by the way, whatever is done in terms of support and bailout, and that will come, and it needs to be done. It needs to be done in a way that supports households and businesses. It needs to be done in a way that, that doesn't necessarily insulate the banks from all the risks that they've taken, because they're culpable.
That's right. The government has to look at the financial system and apply triage. You only save the real stuff, right? There is a role. The government has to step in and save some stuff, but you only save the real stuff. You cannot have the repeat of 2008, where, you know, extreme scenarios like when they bailed out the banks, or in the UK nationalized the banks, there was no quid pro quo. Right, they didn't even make the New York banks give up their damn bonuses that year. And in the case of the British banks, you had this terrible chapter of RBS, which had just been bailed out generously by the taxpayer, then went through its small business book and destroyed thousands of them in very aggressive, almost criminal approach to trying to get itself back in shape. Right, it was the wrong approach. The government allowed that, so you can't allow that. Those sort of things will have to be done. But we need, when we think about the economy, I think what we need to be thinking about now is what do we need to do with the economy right now to make it capable of addressing the crisis we've got, but also then in a more general way, function productively, right? Next week, it looks like Parliament will be sitting, but I expect it to be a stripped back sitting, right? There might just be a bare quorum there. From what I can tell, they're only talking publicly about passing the stimulus package such as it is, so that the parts that have to be legislated. So let's just a quick change of subject here to remind people of this subject. I don't think personally, in the context of everything that's going on, I don't think the cash ban and those issues are going to come up. Now, it's on the notice paper. Right, that's, we do have to take that seriously. It was put on the notice paper for next week, but we've done, you know, your listeners, Citizens Party supporters, Interests of the People supporters, a lot of Australians have done a lot of work here. It was noticed, right? So maybe, you can't rule anything out, maybe under the cover of this I'll ram it through, but if they do it that way, I expect the biggest political blowback of all time, right? And so I'm personally not expecting that, but we'll see. Part of me wishes, Martin, that if that did happen, if the Labor and Liberal parties were going to ignore this issue, the public on this issue on the cash ban, and ram it through, they do it in such a sinister way, right? Because then it will really blow up in their face. But I don't think it's going to happen. But just so people know, we're not ignoring that subject. We're on the case. However, in the world, actually. My wife talked me out of wear. I was going to wear this T-shirt. My wife talked me out of it because she thought I should look more serious. But I was going to be wearing this on this show.
Welcome to reality.
That's my favorite T-shirt. Because when reality asserts itself, you've got to respond.
Yeah. There's a wonderful Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy quote. Reality's on the blink. I actually love that because I think that's that's about where we are. What we thought was the reality, right, is now proven to be not real at all. So the strength and the stability of the financial system that everybody in government and in the, you know, regulators and central banks around the world have said, we've got a really strong, well-capitalized financial system. No, you haven't, right, firstly. And secondly, whatever you've built, you've built it on sandcastles, not on reality, because now real businesses and real households are the ones going to get bulldozed by it.
I'll tell you what businesses don't need bailing out in Australia right now. Coles and Woolworths, obviously.
Yep.
They're having the biggest boom of all time. Why? Because, I mean, they're an important part of the social infrastructure, even though they shouldn't be a duopoly. And that's a business that's based on reality, right?
Yep.
What is in trouble is the further you get removed from reality. So, for instance, we have, and I feel sorry for them, but over the decades we shut down enormous numbers of local industries around Australia and said you can have tourism instead. And the survivors of that made the tourism work, but tourism is incredibly vulnerable to this, right? That a lot of the airline, there would always be an airline business, but a lot of the airline business is exposed to this sort of thing. And so, you know, you can't lose the airlines, but dare I say, as someone who opposed the privatisation of Qantas in the first place, if the government's going to rescue them, I wouldn't be opposed to them nationalising it. Right, because there has to be a trade-off. It hasn't been a better business in private hands, in my view. The S in Qantas stands for service, not business, right? Decades and decades and decades of investment went into that business, went into that service, sorry, and you know, now they can make a lot of money out of it. If its former management had have had their way before the 2008 global financial crisis, because they had a private equity takeover plan, Qantas wouldn't exist now anyway, like Ansett. You know, so if some of the things you're going to have to take stock and go, you know, well, if it's got to be rescued, we can't, you know, the trade-off has to be in a certain way. So let's do that. But there's, I think, what I'd like people to think about, Martin, because we could, there's a lot of, instead of talking about all the incidentals, because I'd like people to actually be inspired about what's possible. And that's based on the history of Australia's economy, right, and the story of World War II. I think now's the time to look at the story of World War II to realise just how quickly you can turn this around if you have the intention to, right? But you need a catalyst. World War II, the catalyst was war. I think everyone now is acknowledging that, you know, this is the worst pandemic we've seen since 1918 in terms of scale, right? And it, we are very vulnerable to it, more vulnerable because of our financial system and because of our globalised economies. So, you know, there's, while trade is great, if it's truly mutually beneficial, right, so much of what's called free trade has been at the expense of national economies, right, and now's the time to take stock of that and realise we've made ourselves vulnerable and we can turn that around. Let me start with this phrase, which every Australian has heard, ad nauseum, emphasis on ad nauseum, 28 years of uninterrupted economic growth. That's what we're told every time by Labor and Liberal, they both try and claim the credit for it, is the state of our economy. 28 years of uninterrupted economic growth. Well, right now, South Korea has a death rate from coronavirus of 0.9%. And they were able to achieve that with a very aggressive approach, combined with a hospital system that has 12 beds per 1,000 people. Australia's hospital system has less than 4 beds per 1,000 people. And we are not doing anything like Korea's approach, South Korea's approach on testing, right? Even if we did, we have much weaker health infrastructure to deal with the consequences. In 1977, we had 8.1 beds per 1,000 people in Australia. And this is what the Citizens Party has always taken issue with modern economics. They found a way to, they used metrics to define growth, which we regard as absolute BS, right? If your growth is coming at the expense of the very important systems, if you think you're rich but you can't sustain very important systems that can protect you in a crisis like this, then you're kidding yourself, right? You're like the racing car driver that in order to get faster and faster and faster takes off the roll bars and all the other heavy stuff, right? To get that speed, you'll get the speed, but you'll die like that. Right. And that's crazy. So that's this is a delusion. It's a self-delusion the two major parties have, and we've got to change it. So I think that comparison with Australia's health system and South Korea is very important. Right. Because South Korea has been incredibly successful in dealing with this. When South Korea, for the, people probably remember this, that South Korea's figures erupted not that long ago, just a month or probably less. And it was an interesting story because the explosion of cases in South Korea came through this church, this rather obscure church, right? And people might remember that on the news. Well, so they had an explosion. They had more cases then than we have in Australia now. But what did they do? Well, there's an article that we can link to that we're linking to into this in our press release by ProPublica on the 15th of March. They reported, this was their description of what South Korea did. They saw the outbreak in China. They saw their figures rising. Within weeks, they got four companies to develop a test based on the WHO's recipe. So the WHO had the genome map from China, right? So China, of course, is scrambling to first to figure this out and, you know, how we're going to, so that they had a harder problem. South Korea was able to watch that and go, okay, that's what they've got. Let's prepare for that. Right. So they had the same opportunity as we did. They appear to have taken advantage of that opportunity, right, in terms of time to have noticed. So they got the test and they started testing aggressively 10,000 people per day, right? Including they set up these drive-through testing facilities. 10,000 people per day. As of Saturday, this last Saturday, they've tested more than 248,000 people and identified 8,086 cases. So far, 72 have died, or 0.9%. Right? That's incredible. The way I saw another description was they hunted the virus down. Right? No laissez-faire, nothing. You know, we're gonna track this thing and we're gonna nip it in the bud. South Korea had learned the lesson from the MERS, apparently, because one of the stories with MERS was the South Koreans saw that half of their cases with MERS came from people going from hospital to hospital looking for a test, and they contracted it at the hospital, right? So South Korea learned that lesson. But the more important point is they have a very good health system, right, as evidenced by those beds per thousand, and they actually have a very productive economy, of course, right? South Korea is an incredibly productive economy. So there's a contrast there that we should be looking at and go, can we in Australia emulate that, right? And in principle, we can think, yeah, we should, but can we? We're way lacking in beds, right? We're way lacking in staff and clinical experts to service those beds. I remember it was probably a decade ago, I saw this statistic that in the course of 15 or 20 years, the number of Victorian trained hot doctors had increased by one in 10 years. All the increase had come from importing them from overseas, places like Botswana, where the Botswanan government paid for their education for free, trained them up to be doctors, and then we'd go and poach them, because we were too busy kidding ourselves that a bubble in property was an economy to realise the importance of putting real money into training doctors ourselves, right? So these are the vulnerabilities Australia's got. If you're in rural Australia, do not take this as a racist statement at all, because it's not, because I love them. I love these people very much. But if you're in a rural Australia, you don't know what a white doctor looks like anymore. Bless their souls. They're all Indians. They're all Asian. And thank God for them, right? But they're the ones that are prepared to go out there. And, you know, so this is the state of our health system. The other contrast is to China. I don't want to say too much, but I want to quote David Llewellyn Smith, who I'm sure he and I would have fierce arguments on China. So David Llewellyn Smith from Macro Business. But even he has acknowledged the difference China has a huge problem in Wuhan and Hubei province to deal with, a huge problem, right? And everyone knows that they just threw everything at it. Once they took it seriously and figured out this was a problem, they threw everything at it. And it has worked. Mm-hmm. Forget all the disinformation out there. It's absolutely worked. And David Llewellyn Smith made this point between Australia and China in terms of economies. He said, Australia's economy is based upon a confidence trick of endless mortgage and house price inflation and is the very definition of fragile when history comes calling. By comparison, China can shut down and not collapse because it has real economic activity at its base. A massively productive economy that makes real stuff and real money. Yes, it's got other problems, blah, blah, blah. And he's referencing the bubble but the bubble doesn't define the whole Chinese economy like it defines ours. But at the end of the day, because it has an economic base, not just fluffy superstructure, it can look after its people better and weather this shock economically more so than consumer societies can. And I think if Australians take stock of that, it should actually make them quite nervous about the, you know, if that's what it took for those two countries to be successful in dealing with this, what's it going to take here?
Yeah, well, the point is we came probably late to the party. We still seem to be fuddling around a bit at the edges in terms of what to do. And, you know, the lessons from, I think, South Korea probably are the most stark. There is a way to shut this down, but you have to be deadly intent. And as you say, it's hunting the virus, isn't it?
It is. So what we're doing today is calling for an economic mobilization, right? So the front line is health, and all the resources have to be thrown at that. But you also got to, while the government's doing that, it has to make sure the economy functions. So for instance, the first thing is forget the bubble, it's going to go anyway, right? I just saw, I shared with you a little while ago, Christopher Joy's pronouncement about the Australian housing market last week, where he said it's an island of excellence in a sea of volatility. Well, that kind of illusion, let them hang on to that. So people are clinging to that delusion. That doesn't matter at a time like this. And unfortunately, it's going to have consequences because, of course, you know, so much credit has been flowing through the economy on the back of lending to housing, and we're going to have to replace that. But first of all, you know, how do we gear up our health system so that I think we should. I'm not the health expert, but you learn from the best. So if we chose to hunt down the virus like South Korea did, can we do it? Can we do the mass testing? Well, you're going to run into problems with other tests available. Do we have the, and when you identify people, because we've only got 4 beds per 1,000, how can we increase that, right? There are politicians in the United States calling for the Army Corps of Engineers to get involved, and that's a very good call because they're capable of doing that. I don't know, to be honest, what the Australian equivalent of that would be, but if we've got it, we should use it, right? Because you're going to have to expand capacity. Mm. We need respirators, right? People getting, we know what happens. They get pneumonia and they can be in intensive care for 4 weeks and a bunch will die, but a bigger bunch will survive. But if they're not going to die, they need respirators. They need oxygen in their lungs. I'm sure we don't have enough, right? But can we, these things are not rocket science. Can we retool existing factories that produce all sorts of things, right? And say you're now producing respirators. I just heard Chris Bowen ask this, the former assistant shadow treasurer, in a press conference while I was driving here. He said, "Oh well, if companies can do that, they should come forward." Tom Tugendhat of the UK government put out a tweet calling for the equivalent. If you know how to do this, contact us. No. The government takes charge. You find out who does it, and that's their job, right? No. And they'll get rewarded for it, but not. You know, they're not going to profiteer, but they'll be rewarded for it. But that's their job now. You just do this is a mobilization. That's what you've got to do. We need massive quantities of this. Now that China has had some success, they are ramping up production, but they've also got a monitor, and they're monitoring very closely for a secondary outbreak, right? And they have to, and so they're testing everyone like mad, you know. But apparently, as of last week, they were producing 100 million N95 masks a day, right? And that's great, and they will send those around the world. But this is a vulnerable time. Will they have a secondary outbreak, etc.? We should be able to produce those here, right? Mm-hmm. Why not? So we know that's the sort of equipment we need. Right, so you call on all the resources to say that's the job now, that's the task. The government needs to also be thinking, well, we need to keep continuity of the real economy. You know, although Coles and Woolies are making a lot of money, you might have heard this, it's pretty crazy. They've shut down their food delivery service. Now, that's more important now than ever. That food delivery service. They shut it down because of the lack of stock, obviously, because of the frenzied buying. But that can't be allowed to happen, right? The government needs to make sure that's, you know, so from the farm or the factory to the supermarket, that is essential. That keeps going. So I think the way South Korea or China would deal with that is you aggressively screen all those people all the time. So if any one of those people who are very important right now in that supply chain, if they get sick, you know, quarantine them, get them out of there, you know, quarantine those around them, make sure you nip it in the bud, right, so that the supply chain can keep functioning. Very, very important. That applies to energy supplies, you know, the power stations have to keep going, all that sort of thing. And, you know, this is more important than people might think, right, because if you have a laissez-faire approach to it, especially if you get a breakout in a vulnerable area, my goodness, the knock-on effect can be huge, right? So the enemy is invisible, but we know how to detect it, right? And so, you know, these are the sort of things that have to be done. I think just north of me and here in Coburg, we have Commonwealth Serum Laboratories. When I ride past on my bike, it's a massive complex. Now, CSL is very famous nowadays for the biggest share price in the world, I think, right? Most profitable company in the world over 25 or 30 years, biggest profits, consistent profits. That was the very first company that Hawke and Keating privatized in the 80s. This was an organization built over decades by the Australian people, the Australian public, right, for precisely this kind of emergency. And I haven't seen anything involved of CSL's involvement in the response to the coronavirus. That's what it was there for. Now it's just a big medicine manufacturer, biotech stuff, making lots and squillions of dollars, right? But it wasn't actually designed for that. That company should be conscripted and said, we need your help. You, whatever capacity you got, that now applies to, you know, nipping this sort of thing in the bud. That sort of approach. Now, there's an element of what I'm doing that's brainstorming, right, in the sense that it's putting up the type of things that the government needs to be doing.
But, Robbie, the point is here is the cultural norms that we've got in Australia are very different from Korea or China, right? But clearly there are times when you've got to do a bit of the thou shalt do this and exhibit strong leadership rather than seeking consensus and all those things. Because, frankly, we don't have time to let consensus bubble up from the bottom, because by then it'll be too late.
You're absolutely right. I think it comes to the most important ingredient in leadership is credibility, though. And that's what I think it comes down to for Australia. If Australians keep listening to the half-hearted, mealy-mouthed messages coming out of the health minister and the prime minister and the chief medical officer, like on Sunday, right, they're going to have no confidence. But if they know that everything that the government is doing is with a plan of attack, well, then you fall in behind that. The comparison is, we don't have the authoritarian cultures of Asia, but we do have. Think about wartime, right? Things like rationing. Everyone just had to do it. It was essential. You had to adopt the rationing. We had such a good post-war economy, really, very productive for many, many years, and good health systems, and we had penicillin, and we had all those benefits, and they lasted for a long time, that when it was starting to be dismantled, and that's the word we use, they dismantled it all in the name of neoliberalism, people took it for granted, and they shouldn't have, right? But they also shouldn't see an event like this as a black swan in that sense. There was, we'll be writing in our publication that we'll be printing tomorrow, this article about our friends in the United States around the economist Lyndon LaRouche were writing about this in 1975. The CIA in 1980 did a very comprehensive study on the threat of future pandemics. And I'm not raising that in a conspiracy way. This is part of its job, right, to do these kind of analysis. And it's just, you know, this experts have always known this is there. There's a potential that this can erupt anywhere, anytime, right? If they hadn't have been all over Ebola back in 2014 in Africa, that could have easily spread and done a lot more damage, right? But they went and dealt with it straight away. That approach, this is much more contagious than one of those things, right? And that's why it's got out so fast. And we have to take it seriously. And if that means quarantine, if that means lockdown for a while, etc., you just got to do that. Right. But if you will do it if you have confidence. And that's what we're saying. The government needs to is this government capable of? I don't know. But the recipe is the government has to be credible and needs to show the people they don't have an ulterior motive here. And if you don't have an ulterior motive and it's just about solving the problem, the public will support it.
Right. Right? And I think, Robbie, the point there is there's a difference between real leadership and marketing spin.
Yes.
And my view is that so far what we've seen is too much marketing spin, too many compromises between economics and health, rather than actually playing it straight down the line like it is with all the information, a little bit more directive, a little bit more perhaps some controlling. But that's what we need if we're going to be able to tackle the virus in the short term. I'd also argue that this is precisely what we need also, because we're going to have to rebuild our economy. Yes. And actually, you know, this crisis creates an opportunity. It's a real opportunity to lay the foundations for a much better economy and therefore a much better outcome for the average Australian down the track. We have to make sure that we do grasp that opportunity and essentially don't get ourselves, if you like, marketed back into that previous mode of thinking again, and basically say it's a little crisis, it'll go away, and it's back to normal. No. We need a new normal, right?
It's up to the public to insist on that.
Yeah.
Because I think we know who we're talking about. When we're talking about marketing, I don't think a leopard can change its spots, or that particular leopard. The public, though, has to say no, enough's enough. And this is where politics must change, and people's voting can change. So that's a good segue, though, into what I want to talk about from World War II, because it's actually quite inspiring, right? People should be inspired by what we were, what we showed, Australians showed in World War II, what we're capable of, and I think we're capable of it again. But you got to you know, learn the lessons of what we did then, right, and understand the importance of productivity. But I just had a thought, Martin, before we go to that, because, you know, we talk about political spin, etc. I heard the worst example today, though, and this is just how politics is played in the world. But once the Trump administration apparently started dawning on them, this was quite serious, right? They did one of these things, we've got to be the first to have the vaccine. Now, why they have to be the first, who knows? But, you know, that was the thinking. We've got to be the first to have the vaccine. Well, it's great that they're going to be so intent on getting a vaccine, right? That'd be wonderful, but it's just the ego in it. But how do they do it? Not by actually going and pulling out all stops to make a vaccine. There's a German company on the cusp of a vaccine, and they went out and they set out to buy it. So it could be, when it could announce a vaccine, oh, that's an American company, we did it, right? And, you know, that kind of thinking has to go. The world's got to get past that sort of stuff, right? Everyone should keep their independence, in my view. I'm not a globalist, but we can be much more cooperative and friendly with each other, and those things don't matter. Now is a time for real cooperation. And so now I'm going to use a war analogy, which is the opposite sort of framework, because it wasn't cooperation, it was war, but the Allies had to cooperate, and that was an important part of it. And this was a serious threat in Australia, right, in World War II. This was definitely a just war. We were about to be invaded. My grandfather was one of the poor farm boys because he was in the CMF, had been conscripted to go up to Kokoda Track and fight, right, and hold the Japanese off, and it was serious. None of this would have worked without this mobilization. In the space of 3 years, we went from being an economy that we could do a few things, but it was largely agrarian-based economy, right? Very little manufacturing. There was some fledgling stuff. To a manufacturing powerhouse, an out-and-out powerhouse. It was quite extraordinary. And here's how it worked. To underscore how poorly prepared we were, Douglas MacArthur, the American general, had been rescued off the Bataan Peninsula in Philippines, and Roosevelt deployed into Australia from where he was going to lead the South Pacific forces, right? He was the supreme commander. When he arrived here and he gets his briefing on what Australia is capable of doing, he later wrote in his memoirs that briefing about how ill-prepared we were to produce what we needed to fight a war, he said that, for me, that was the greatest shock of the war, right? That's where we were at the beginning of this mobilization. Robert Menzies was too busy traveling the world, especially hanging around in the United Kingdom very much all the time. This is another story, but he actually believed, he had people telling him he could replace Churchill as the Prime Minister. And he was pursuing that while he was the Prime Minister of Australia. And Australia's whole defence was based on, oh, the British will protect us from Singapore, and of course it didn't happen. And in fact, when they even had the fixed cannons point the wrong way to even do that, so that wasn't going to work. And we literally had to do it ourselves, right? We had to do this. Now, Lend-Lease was working, and we had some assistance there, but what we did ourselves is quite extraordinary. So John Curtin was the Prime Minister, and I agree with Bob Hawke on one thing: he's the man who saved Australia. Ben Chifley was his Treasurer, and those two guys were kind of unique. And of course, Chifley became Prime Minister after him. Both of them were fierce advocates of the Commonwealth Bank given maximum powers as Australia's national bank. And this hadn't been allowed to be done in the Depression years, right? Because the Liberals, or United Australia Party, were completely in the pockets of the big banks, and the big banks just didn't want to compete with the Commonwealth Bank, right? And so they had neutered it. They took advantage of the war to give it back its powers. Right, so that was an important part of the institution. We're big advocates of a national bank for that reason, because it can provide the credit to do these things that, you know, private banks just won't do. It's long-term investing, and it can be more flexible, etc. It can provide ballast for the private financial system as well. So they had that mechanism, and then they needed to just make sure they knew they had the expertise to do the job, right? But we needed to be able to manufacture anything we needed for the war. And what they did was proof that they weren't ideological, right? They put the national interest first. They turned to Essington Lewis to do this. Essington Lewis was the head of BHP. Now, in those days, BHP was not a mining company. It was a steelmaker that mined as well, right? But mainly it mined to be able to make steel. He was Australia's greatest industrialist, Essington Lewis. He was a total blue blood Tory, right? Grew up hating Labor, but that wasn't the point. He loved Australia. There was a war on, right? That was the point. And they said, this guy knows how to produce things. We need him to run it. They made him the director of munitions. And from that directorate, Essington Lewis oversaw an incredible mobilization, right? They just got, they turned around the whole country, the whole economy, like I said, in 3 years. And the guts of it, there's lots of things they do we won't go into detail, but the guts of it was we became really advanced machine tool manufacturers. The machine tools are the core of your manufacturing capacity because they're the machines that make other machines, right? And we couldn't make any at the start of the war. By the end of the war, we could make whatever we wanted. And all the main capital cities and a few others had railway workshops, right? And all those railway workshops from Ipswich in Brisbane to Midland over in Perth, et cetera, all the way around Australia, they became the center of this manufacturing, right? Especially the machine tool manufacturing, because some machine tools are huge and you could only make them near the railway, put them on the railway truck and send them to the next city, et cetera. But by the end of it, we could do whatever we wanted. Those workshops produced whatever machines we wanted, and they produced countless apprentices, tradesmen, right? Our skill workforce for Australia that we enjoyed post-war were created in those workshops, right? For decades and decades and decades. They're all museums now if they even exist. But this is what we did. And it's just in 3 years. So by the end of the war, right, we weren't just capable, we were exceptional at what we did. And of course, that's what Chifley and people along with him tried to keep going by setting up the car industry and stuff like that. But if you think about 3 years, right, that's a blink of an eye. But it made Australia the economy we are today. That's how we need to be thinking in terms of this. So that's what's possible, right? And what we're saying is now let's be inspired by that and realize if we can do it, then we can do it now. But we've got to apply those lessons, right? Get the right people in the right job, have the right intention to do it, use the right institutions to make it work, right? Laissez-faire doesn't cut it, right? There's plenty of free enterprise economy for everyone to do their thing in. That always works. But it's the government, not as a separate entity. It's the government that's the representative of the collective of the people, all of us, right? That's responsible for the common good, right? We make it do the right thing and say, okay, this is the direction we're going to go because this episode shows we need to. We've had 40 years of neoliberalism and globalization. It was gradually eroding away anyway with a few shocks. Now we've had a massive one. It's time to turn this all around.
Yeah, and Robbie, the way I summarize it is that if you think about the government, you know, doing some stuff, then we've got the people, the banks are supporting, whereas currently the banks are actually in hot with the government, right? And basically the poor old people are left out in the cold. It's that transformational approach, which is actually quite visionary, I think, which is what we need to do. And if we do that, boy, the world could be our oyster.
It could be. And just to illustrate that, we can provide the link, but last year, Dr. Wilson Tsai gave a presentation at our Sydney seminar, and he just showed through the statistics of the Australian economy that actually our economic direction, by and large, has been set by the profit-oriented lending decision of the banks for too long, right? Not by any actual direction. It's just whatever the banks decided made them the most money, and that was a property bubble, right? And that's where that should never have been allowed to happen, right? You make sure the public hold their government accountable and say, no, we want a productive economy and make it happen.
Yep. Well, Robbie, I appreciate your time today, and we'll put a link through to that release when it's available. I'm sure we'll be talking again, but the point is we need to understand that this is an opportunity to do things differently ahead. And if we make those choices and, you know, push our politicians in the right direction, despite all the difficulties we're going to face in the immediate future, we can actually lay some foundations for a better future.
Yeah. Agreed. Thanks, Robbie. Thanks,
man. See you later. Thank you. So there you have it. Very, very important message from Robbie. There is an opportunity here in the midst of all the disaster and the financial mess that we're looking at to lay the foundations for a better future. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. And thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.